The card features a black and white image captured on a long ago Christmas season evening at the top of Grafton Street. And at first, I assume that it must have been the woman on the right of the foreground who caught the photographer's attention. Cool and composed in an elegant fur-coloured coat and carrying what appears to be an expensive leather handbag. Her resemblance to Jackie Kennedy is quite startling. But, if anything, she is even more beautiful. Her companion has close-cut black hair, dark, deep-set eyes, and has the air of a prince about him. He's wearing a light-coloured crombie, or maybe a trench coat. Linking her arm, his head is lowered to her left shoulder as he turns to face the impertinent photographer. Immortalised, they are both impossibly glamorous. Directly over the couple, a large star is the highest point of one of many strands of Christmas lights slung between the rooftops in a pattern as far as the camera can see. A slur of light directly in front of them might be a passing car. The suggestion of speed looks almost painted onto the negative. There are other cars there too. Squat, functional shapes in the background. They disappear from view at that slight curve on the street's gentle hill. Behind them, the shops have names I'm remembering suddenly from childhood. A group of people walk past their firmly shut doors and darkened windows. They may have been moving too quickly for the camera's shutter speed, or perhaps it was decided later on in the darkroom that their images should have a lesser sharpness. I notice that despite their sensible winter coats, the women are wearing shiny, sharp-heeled shoes and have very good legs. All are oblivious except one. A half-turning blur as she glances over her shoulder at the photographer, her expression has the fleeting clarity of a transient moment. Behind the bus stop, designated for routes 10, 11, 13 and 14, a straggled queue waits. In the middle of it, a lone man in a flat cap looks as if he is lost in his own thoughts of that impending Christmas. But I can almost hear the hum of conversation from the women around him who are busy doing what Dubliners always do best in these situations. And this is where Josie comes into the picture. She is second in line behind someone who looks vaguely familiar to me. That woman lowers her head and tilts her eyes upwards to show a coy profile to the camera. But Josie has no such qualms about confronting the photographer's interest. She is not at all fazed at being included in yet another image from a Dublin now long past. This is the Josie who, after all, featured in the Irish Times, being carried through a flood outside her flat on Mount Street. The same Josie who took up half the front page in the evening press as she was helped onto an army lorry during a bus strike. Her stance is relaxed and casual, just as I remember it. Her right hand is deep inside the pocket of her coat, and I find myself wondering if, on the hand I can't see, she is wearing the ruby and diamond engagement ring given to me in a hospice envelope on the night of her funeral. It never leaves my finger. And so she comes back to me now, an utterly unexpected gift from the shades, received by way of a black and white photograph on a set of Christmas cards in a box bought hastily during the final week for posting. And not even looked at properly until I get home. Singular and direct in the way she faces the camera, she, out of everyone else in the picture, is the most clearly defined. It's then I have the strangest feeling that it might have been Josie, my mother's youngest sister, my godmother, sweetly innocent and always curious, whose mid-November birthday I missed sharing by only 5 minutes, and not that glittering couple, who prompted the photographer into raising his lens to meet her grey-eyed gaze on Grafton Street that evening, in the run-up to Christmas, 1961.
It was a dark, wet, end-of-year day in the mid-1980s. And the centre of Dublin, under that lingering, gritty smog that preceded the introduction of smokeless fuels, was like something from a Charles Dickens novel. Like so many at the time, I was unemployed, passing the hours by busking and doing a little voluntary work, and emerging empty-handed yet again from the manpower office on Dallier Street. The grim reality of the season was what was on my mind when I heard or felt someone come up behind me. When I turned, I found a stranger with his hand extended. "Mike," he said with a smile. Then he froze. "Mick? Mike? Remember me?" And he said his name. Let's say it was Dave. I shook my head. "I met you down in Limerick," he said. "During the summer, was it?" He was about 10 years older than me, shorter, stocky, casually dressed with a cap and shoulder bag. "I don't think so," I said politely. And then I realised what might have happened. "Maybe you know my brother," I said. "His name is M," and I said my brother's name. "And he's a couple of years younger than me, but..." And I explained how, in our then temporary goth phases, we were occasionally mistaken for each other. "And it's your brother who lives in Limerick," Dave was trying to piece it together now, too. "Well, not exactly," I said, "but he was down there a few months back visiting another brother of ours who's not like either one of us for his birthday." This was getting slightly comical now, but Dave was sure and seemed relieved that we'd managed between us to figure it out. "Well, there you are," he said. "Should must have been him I bumped into." And like me, he appeared to look for a way to end this odd encounter and move on. And then the gods intervened, and the first sharp tips of icy rain pummeled the row of parked up buses, one of which had been destined to carry me home. Dave turned up his collars. "Don't know about you," he said, looking up, "but I think I'll sit this one out. You fancy one?" And he made the international sign of drinking. A persistent slight tickle at the back of my throat allowed me to imagine that a hot whiskey might not be the worst idea in the world. And so we adjourned to a nearby pub and, in the event, stayed well beyond nightfall. He bought one, I bought the next. And when I couldn't keep up, physically or financially, we settled into our own comfortable rhythms. The rain beat down. I talked about busking, about writing. He talked a little, not much, about Lebanon, about serving there with the Irish peacekeeping mission, a fact that I supposed explained his vaguely military attire. Around about 9, he remembered he'd agreed to meet some friends in another city centre pub, and again, I found myself persuaded. It was, after all, more or less on my way home. So we walked up Grafton Street, passing the animated children's characters in Switzer's window, passing Tom McGinty, the famous dice man, after a long day of absolute stillness, finally on his way home. In the pub, when I returned from the bar, Dave had already located his friends, a young, happy-go-lucky couple, and we spent now until closing time in yarns and light-headed laughter. It was only after we bade them good night outside on the street, a few hours later, that Dave realised he'd missed his last bus home. The best I could offer was a sleeping bag on my floor, which Dave happily accepted. We drank tea against the cold, and then the length of the day and the night took its toll. In the morning, I awoke sore and stiff, but lighter in myself, the way you do, to find Dave gone. How long was it before I noticed my stereo was also gone? My precious record collection was also gone. My battered old guitar was also gone. But worse, much worse, when I opened the wardrobe. The near-priceless, custom-built electric guitar a friend had left with me for safekeeping only days before was gone as well. Everything of value in that tiny, single-room, down-at-heel flat spirited away while I slept. But how had he done it? In the days before mobile phones, calling a taxi from the communal phone down in the hall with its button A and its button B. Even so, he'd have had to come back upstairs to my room from the street at least twice, maybe three times, in order to gather up all the goodies he'd taken. And what if I'd woken up? And the other question that troubled me, when had he decided to rob me? When he'd sat up that morning and discovered me there still asleep, my precious, meagre possessions spread out for the taking? Or was it the night before, or the day before? The very moment he'd spotted me on the street, something trusting or vulnerable or just plain dumb, in my eyes, in my expression, singling me out. And why pick the one guy who looked like he hadn't a bob to his name? I puzzled it over and over, but never made any sense. And when I returned to the pub the following night to locate his friends, it turned out that the first time they'd ever met Dave was the night he'd sat down beside them. The previous night, he'd sat down beside them and introduced himself while Muggins was ordering our first drinks at the bar. And 20 years on, it's still a kind of seasonal mystery. The man who called himself Dave, the opposite of Santa Claus, one might say, arriving in his case in full view of all and vanishing by stealth. And instead of bringing the usual seasonal gifts, taking every blessed thing I owned, spiriting them up and away, up my coal-burning, wind-whispering Victorian chimney, as I imagined it. The two bemused guards that were sent up from Kevin Street Station to dust for fingerprints. Stood there on either side of it, like a pair of angels, resisting the temptation to laugh.
It started with a song on a crisp, clear night, December 24th, 1914. The weather up till then had been wet, but temperatures dropped on Christmas Eve
and a hard frost settled on the trenches of the Western Front. During the afternoon, British soldiers noticed miniature Christmas trees with candles and paper lanterns appearing along the German parapets. And then, coming up to 7 in the evening, the German soldiers began to sing. Stille Nacht, or Silent Night, is the carol most associated in the popular imagination with the first and only Christmas truce of the First World War. But soldiers' recollections suggest other carols played a more prominent part in the event. Rifleman Graham Williams of the 5th London Rifle Brigade admitted he'd never heard of Silent Night. It was Come All Ye Faithful that stuck in his mind because it was a tune both sides knew, although the German troops sang the Latin version, Adeste Fideles. The soldiers found common cause in hymns and carols, anthems and parlor songs. On that Christmas Eve, there were renditions of Home Sweet Home, It's a Long Way to Tipperary, The First Noel, Auld Lang Syne, While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks, and O Tannenbaum, as well as God Save the King and Die Wacht am Rhein. The music was the precursor of something much more revolutionary, however, an unofficial and illicit truce. When dawn arrived, we started putting our heads above the parapet and waved to each other, Private Cunningham of the 5th Scottish Rifles remembers. On our left was a brewery occupied by the Germans, and to our surprise, we saw a German come out and hold his hand up. Behind him were two rolling a barrel of beer. They came halfway across and signed to us to come for it. Three of us went out, shook hands with them, wished them a Merry Christmas, and rolled the barrel to our own trenches. After that, it was understood that peace was declared for a day. Scenes like this were repeated all along a 27-mile section of the Western Front between Messines and Neuve-Chapelle on Christmas Day. The dead who had lain in no man's land for a week were buried and prayers said over them in English and German. Men from both sides met and talked, exchanged gifts of cigarettes, souvenirs, and keepsakes. There were impromptu games of soccer. It's estimated that about 100,000 soldiers participated in the truce. Despite the scale of it, or perhaps because of it, some believed it had never happened, that it was a myth concocted for propaganda purposes. Private Pat Collard wrote to his parents that the truce was all lies. The sniping went on just the same. In fact, our captain was wounded, so don't believe what you see in the papers. Private Collard's experience was also true. The impromptu truce was widespread, but it was not total. In some parts of the Western Front, shelling and firing continued throughout Christmas Day, and so did the fatalities. The first overtures were generally made by German troops, perhaps because Christmas Eve is the focus of festive celebrations in the German tradition. Nevertheless, there was strong resistance within the German ranks to fraternizing with the enemy. One soldier, a certain Corporal Adolf Hitler of the 16th Bavarians, berated his comrades for unmilitary conduct. Such things should not happen in wartime. Have you Germans no sense of honor left at all? He asked. Others, after the bruising and bloody First Battle of Ypres just a month before, were too war-weary to contemplate celebrating Christmas at all. A German Hussar officer, Captain Rudolf Binding, wrote to his father from Flanders, I cannot attain to the lack of imagination necessary to celebrate Christmas in the face of the enemy. Enemy, death, and a Christmas tree, they cannot live so closely together. Historians have grappled with the question of what if? What if the truce had held? Stanley Weintraub, author of A History of the Christmas Truce, has suggested that the impromptu revolt by thousands of ordinary soldiers had the potential to be one of those spontaneous movements that topple tyrants and autocrats. but in the end, military discipline reasserted itself. And very soon, it was business as usual. Lance Corporal Henderson of the Royal Engineers recalls that at midnight on St. Stephen's night, an alarm went up where he was. We stood up till daybreak when we found that our pals of the previous 2 days had tried to rush our position. The next morning, the ground where we had been so chummy and where Germans had wished us a Merry Christmas was now covered with their dead.
There's a warmth about Christmas that has nothing to do with blazing fires, nothing to do with the frantic need to shop, and nothing to do with a surfeit of food or drink, or any of the other extraneous baubles that come trailing in the season's wake. Instead, that warmth sheds light and disperses its own kindliness. It's the warmth we label memory, and it brings the happy ghosts of Christmas past to life again. And these old ghosts and new are like the rest of us. They come in all shapes and sizes. They come as remembered friends and in the tantalizing outlines of gifts given and received. But come they do at Christmas time. My ghosts are many. I think back to the Christmases in Castledermot and our family tradition of not opening the presents till the dinner had been eaten and the dishes washed and dried. On one of those Christmas afternoons, I was delegated to take the dogs for a ramble while my sister and brother did the washing up. I lost track of time and followed the dogs over Rice's Hill and across the rocks, only returning home as the Angelus bell was ringing, to be met with a sitting room filled with frustrated faces and still unopened presents. I remember a Christmas morning when I was 11, a morning when a village wrapped in freshly fallen snow appeared outside my window. I was serving at early mass, and I set out at 7:30 on a road that was untouched by tires or footsteps. Mine were the first feet to walk the wilderness that morning, and Abbeylands and Carlow Gate, the School Lane and Abbey Street were my own vast Antarctic. And then there were the card games. 25s around the fold-out table. The same coins played for night after night through the Christmas season and into the bright new year. The neighbours calling to join in mammoth games that ran well past my normal bedtime. O'Connell's and Hunt's and Bridie Bray from Tullamore. And my father's dealing mantra of diamonds dearly bought for ladies. And let the last hour be the hardest, as my mother hit his five of trumps with her joker to take the final game in the small hours of another day. There was the picture house on the Sunday before Christmas. Peter Murphy distributing his largesse. Every child's ticket a winner in the Christmas draw. And only now it strikes me that Santa Claus often dispensed his own generosity through Peter Murphy's compassion for the children of a village for whom the season provided less than they perpetually hoped it might. I remember our first television arriving on a Christmas Eve, rented from a shop in Carlow. The rental man on the frosty roof twisting the aerial, his companion in the sitting room shouting instructions through the open window. And then the magic of a picture on the screen. And midnight mass, Mrs. Aylmer at the organ, the choir in full voice wishing joy to the world, the chatter afterwards outside the porch, returned emigrants sporting fancy clothes and English accents, and the year I heard Santa's sleigh bells on the roof in the moments before sleep. And years later, my 5-year-old daughter opening the hall door onto another shining Christmas morning, standing amazed at the snow before her. It's as deep as a goose, she says. And there's the snowman my son rescued from the garden and lodged in the freezer. A refuge where the snowman slept for 15 years. And then there's Davy Ellard's Christmas card that rode beside me in the car in the weeks up to last Christmas. I kept meaning to drop it through his letterbox. Davy, who had welcomed us when we moved to Royal Oak 2 summers back. Davy, whose garden was a mutiny of colour from April till November. Davy, who had always taken the time to lean across the wall and chat. As the slow days drifted through the Indian summer that was last year's autumn, he was no longer in the garden. There were hospital visits and then hospital stays. The news was not the best. Occasionally, I'd see a light in the house, but I didn't call. You don't want to be disturbing people when they're just back home, I thought. I leave it closer to the Christmas time and drop him in a card. And then, at last, the lights disappeared. We buried Davy on the first day of this year down in the cemetery at Wells. The Christmas card is still in my car. I think of Davy now, Davy and all the ghosts. I think of those I loved and those I love. They crowd together here tonight. They sit behind me. They stand at my shoulder. They smile their smiles and bring that warmth that's at the heart of Christmas time. And if I listen, I can hear their words and I can say the things I never dared to say. Belief becomes an absolute, if only for this one short winter day.